from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning in our opening hour, should police officers be able to search mobile phones of people they arrest without a warrant? We'll talk about the cell phone privacy issue being heard today at the United States Supreme Court. Then at 9:30, Israel risks becoming an apartheid state if efforts fail to reach a peace settlement. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said that on Friday and amended it later. That was during a closed-door meeting. U.S. officials have until now avoided using that charged term in discussing Israeli policies. We'll talk about Kerry's remark and the gridlocked Israeli-Palestinian peace talks, as well as the recent pact made between the PLO and Hamas. Forum is next. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. What rights do Americans have to privacy and the data contained in their cell phones? That's the issue being taken up by the United States Supreme Court today, and the justices are hearing oral arguments in two cases dealing with police searches of mobile phones when suspects are arrested. We'll continue to update you on any news as it may unfold, but we want to talk with Rory Little about what the Supreme Court's hearing and what's likely to unfurl. He's professor of law at UC Hastings College of the Law, and he joins us by phone this morning. Rory Little, welcome back to Forum.
Thanks. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning to you. Let me begin by having you sketch, if you could briefly, what two cases, one in Boston, one in San Diego, actually are before the court.
Well, the issue in both cases is what can a police officer do when they arrest somebody and they seize their cell phone? It's routine for the police when they arrest somebody to take everything out of their pockets or take their belongings that they're carrying and search them. And this has been a rule for a long time. You can search someone incident to the arrest. The theory is you want to prevent any access to dangerous weapons, and you want to preserve any evidence that they might otherwise try to destroy. Well, now we have cell phones, which means we're carrying our entire lives, in a sense, in our pocket. Both of these cases involve people who were arrested, and then the officers pressed a few buttons and flipped through things in their cell phone. The California case called Riley involves a very extensive search with photos and videos. All of this evidence was used then later against these people in their criminal cases. So the question is there a limit on what you can do with a cell phone? Is it different than the wallet you're carrying in your pocket?
Well, it gets down to the Fourth Amendment, doesn't it?
Well, it's the Fourth Amendment, which says, no unreasonable searches and seizures. And generally, the rule is you have to get a warrant before you search. Now, the search incident to arrest is an exception to the warrant requirement, but there still have to be some limits on it. It also gets down a little bit, in my mind, to the First Amendment, because people use their cell phones for expression. They collect iTunes libraries. They make videos. They do selfies. So there's a little bit, it seems to me, of not just privacy, but also expressive right in these cases.
So it really boils down to whether during an arrest, I mean, any kind of arrest, or for that matter, police stopping you for going through a light or anything of a stop sign, whether they have a right to search the contents of your mobile phone without a warrant. And as I understand it, I mean, when you look back at the 1979 Supreme Court, Smith versus Maryland, didn't the Supreme Court find that it was constitutional to go without a warrant to phone records?
Well, yes, phone records that you've released to a third party. In other words, they can get those phone records from somebody else. Now, this is a case where they're seizing it directly from you. The difficulty here is that the government says, look, with technology, sophisticated drug dealers can have instant wiping of their cell phones. So if they're carrying evidence around on them, we need to be able to search it immediately. We don't have time to get a warrant. The response from Jeff Fisher, who's a law professor at Stanford, who's representing the defendant in the California case, is, well, you can carry a Faraday bag, which blocks the signals from a cell phone, which are not very common right now, or you could put it in airplane mode. So the technology is always sort of advancing much more quickly than the law can accommodate, and that's the issue in this case. When they set a rule today, they're going to be setting it for technology in the future that we can't even anticipate. Of course, 5 years ago, you didn't have a smartphone in your pocket.
So, the court is going to have to make the decision based on, we go back to kind of stronger or weaker constructionism, don't we, in terms of the Constitution, how it applies to the present?
Yes, this really brings, I mean, this is a very big case because it forces the court to really go all the way back and confront sort of fundamental constitutional interpretive, you know, ideas. The Fourth Amendment, of course, the framers had no thought of cell phones, so you can't say they had any specific intention here. On the other hand, they didn't like the British government and soldiers searching them intrusively. Interestingly, Justice Scalia, who was often viewed as a conservative, has taken a very liberal view with regard to protection of privacy against the government. He says things like, the proud framers would never have allowed the British soldiers to scrape their cheeks for DNA samples. Well, that was in a dissent last term when they held that when you're arrested, they can scrape your cheek for a DNA sample. Justice Scalia dissented in that case. Meanwhile, Justice Breyer, who has always worked for the federal government when he wasn't being a law professor, tends to defend the government in these cases. So the politics are somewhat swapped. And the idea of what would the framers have intended is really irrelevant. It seems to me that you've got to decide what does society think is reasonable today. I think most people think intrusive searches into their cell phone is pretty unreasonable.
Well, but a lot of people say, I know I'm not going to get arrested. I have nothing to hide, that sort of thing, don't they? And, I mean, certainly from what I've heard through the years and what I've read.
Well, that's the problem, right, not just in the Bay Area but all over the place. But, I mean, lots of people who are, quote-unquote, not criminals or innocent get arrested in San Francisco when they do protests. You go on the Golden Gate Bridge and you protest, you know, animal rights or something, and the next thing you know, you're spending 6 hours in the lockup. And the idea that the government could go through your cell phone, they're not going to find any evidence to support your protest prosecution. As soon as they seize your cell phone, it's not dangerous. I mean, yes, theoretically, it could be a bomb, so they'll have to separate bombs from cell phones. But the reality here is people do get arrested. The other problem is that in our society, right now, at least in most states, you can be arrested for a traffic violation. You can be arrested for jaywalking in San Francisco. It doesn't usually happen. But if the police want to do this and they want to search your cell phone, the Riley defendant in the Riley case is being argued this morning. It's ending just as we speak, I think. He was initially stopped just for having expired license plates. And the officer decided to arrest him, and that led to the search of the phone.
We're talking to Rory Little, who's professor of law at UC Hastings College of the Law, about the Supreme Court actually hearing a case today as we speak that could determine whether police officers would need warrants to search through the cell phones of individuals they arrest. And you may want to weigh in here. We're going to talk up until the half hour when we go to a break and then come back and talk about the Israel-Palestinian peace talks, which seem to have come to a halt and have all kinds of new wrinkles to them. But in the meantime, you can join us and weigh in here. In fact, we welcome your phone calls. You can join us right now at our toll-free number, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite. That number is 866-733-6786. And if you do have an opinion on this or if you have something you'd like to state, by all means, join us now, because as I said, this is a half-hour segment. You can also raise any questions that you would like to bring to the fore. Again, our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us. Our email address is forum@kqed.org, and you can also tweet us, our Twitter handle, @KQED Forum. Do you think that the Snowden case is hovering over this at all, or plays a role, or will play a role?
The Snowden case, of course, is interesting only because it exposes sort of how much there is out there on the Internet, or how much there is electronically, I guess is the way to put it. Imagine somebody working for the NSA who gets stopped for a speeding violation, officer arrests him, starts flipping through his phone. Next thing you know, he's coming across classified information. I mean, the court really is going to have to struggle now with what the limits are, because the cell phone opens up the cloud and it opens up everything there is. You know, and the court here, this is the interesting thing about the Supreme Court, they have to deal in a single term with campaign finance, religious freedom, affirmative action, gay marriage, and now cell phone privacy. This is not the only thing on their plate. It's a very challenging job to make major decisions that affect all of us.
Forgive me, they just made a decision that environmentalists are celebrating, as I'm sure you're aware, about downwind pollution.
I mean, this morning, I mean, almost every case, they only hear 75 cases a term, but almost every case involves questions that affect, you know, it's not millions of people, thousands of people, and our big policy questions. We have a very interesting society where we rely on the Supreme Court often to settle very difficult social issues that we can't even agree on legislatively. This may be one of them. Various states have taken various positions. Some states say you cannot search a cell phone without a warrant. Other states say that you can. California passed a law saying you needed a warrant, and Governor Brown vetoed it and said it's better for the courts. So where this will go legislatively is another big question.
Well, I don't want to make you into a tea leaf reader here, but you did mention before that we have some unpredictability in terms of where Justice Scalia might stand or where Justice Breyer might stand. How do you think this is going to go?
Well, I think the court is afraid of making too sweeping a ruling because they don't know where the technology is going to go. So I would guess this will be a nuanced ruling. It'll be divided, would be my guess. You may see Justice Breyer actually voting for a defendant in a limited way. I think you're going to see rules that say maybe you can't search too intrusively. You can only press a few buttons to make sure that it's not a bomb, I guess. You will have to distinguish, perhaps, between a misdemeanor arrest and a felony arrest. Justice Scalia has suggested you should only be allowed to search for evidence of the crime that you've arrested for. So if you've arrested for speeding, presumably your phone doesn't have information on that. Although I do understand there are certain apps that actually register how fast you're moving when your cell phone's in your pocket.
I think it's fair to say, though, that there are a lot of citizens, certainly who have no arrest record, and as I said earlier when I alluded to the possibility of people being not at all exercised about this because they think they're not violating the law, there are a lot of citizens look on this and say, well, you know, a guy is caught speeding and it turns out to be a drug dealer or a gang member or, you know, a pedophile with child pornography. You know, they're very bullish on the idea that you can get evidence and you should get evidence any way you can.
Yeah, you know, it's always challenging in Fourth Amendment cases because the only people who ever have the ability to raise it in court are people who are convicted of crime. If you're acquitted, then you don't have an appeal. So we're always facing someone who is guilty of something. You know, and this is what the Fourth Amendment is about. This is what the Bill of Rights is all about. I mean, the framers, let's be clear on this. The framers were all crooks. They were all people committing a serious crime against the government. They were committing treason, and they were planning violent acts against their government. And they wrote protections into the Bill of Rights, and they spent a lot of time on the criminal side in the Bill of Rights, saying you can't go past certain lines. You can't go unreasonably. You need to get a warrant, things like that. So the Bill of Rights is designed to be a block, if you will, towards what might be viewed as the most efficient enterprises of government, because in some sense we don't trust the government to always act reasonably. So we had to write it into the Fourth Amendment.
This may be the first time I've heard the founders refer to as crooks.
Well, I teach it every year.
Let's find out what I'm sorry, Rory, you were going to add something?
Well, this is the reality. Why does the Bill of Rights spend so much time on criminal law? There are three or four amendments out of 10 which were on criminal law. It's because they had all been subject to prosecution by the British in ways that they felt were unfair, in ways that they felt were violative of their basic human rights. I mean, the Bill of Rights is actually a very serious human rights document, and it was written by people who feared the government.
We're going to bring our callers in. Let's go first to Berkeley. Ed, you're on. Good morning.
Yes, hi. Good morning to you both.
Yeah, go ahead. You're on the air.
So I'm wondering, I keep hearing about this applying to arrests, but what if you're not arrested but just detained? I mean, would we still be subjected to these kinds of searches when you're being held without an actual charge and an arrest, and sometimes the detainments can actually take hours?
Yeah, Rory Little.
Well, the answer to that, at least in theory, is that you're not supposed to be detained for longer than a few minutes to resolve whatever an officer's reasonable suspicion is, and a search of your cell phone has never been held to be an extensive search as held to be part of that. If you're detained longer than, say, 20 minutes for the officers, you're effectively arrested. The Supreme Court has a de facto arrest doctrine, in which case these things kick in. Normally, the officers cannot search your belongings simply during, let's say, a traffic stop on the side of the road unless they've decided to arrest you.
Let me thank you for the phone, Ed. In fact, we'll get as many of you on here as we can. Let me go next to Los Altos and welcome Todd. Todd, good morning.
Hey, thanks for putting me on. So, you know, when the Patriot Act went into effect, we kind of gave up the Fourth Amendment. And then with the NSA, we realized that the government has completely given up the Fourth Amendment, and now even our cell phones are being searched. I think we have to draw a line in the sand. There has to be a point where privacy is privacy, because this information is often abused. Remember how in the 60s, how the government used information to mess up the people in the civil rights movement. I mean, information like this, widely dispersed, is always abused. And that's what the Fourth Amendment was supposed to protect us from.
Thank you for the call, and thank you for your opinion. It's, I think, maybe axiomatic, Rory, a little, that the difficulty here in wading through this, getting into the weeds, is that police can search your car, they can search your trunk and so forth, and usually a smartphone is just something carried in the pocket. But as you said before, it could be your whole life.
Yeah, and you know, the Supreme Court has a difficult role here. They do not want to get in the way of law enforcement that's effective, and many people would agree with that. But what we should point out, they have recently confronted GPS searches, putting a locator on your car, and the court said, no, you can't do that normally without a warrant. They've confronted things like thermal heat imagers used by the officers on the street to detect indoor grow operations, and they've said, well, you can't do that without a warrant. And last term, they decided that you can't even bring a dog sniffer up onto the front porch and sniff the front porch. That was a case where Justice Scalia wrote a very rousing decision in favor of the sort of the line in the sand. So I agree with the caller. You got to draw a line in the sand. The difficult thing is where to draw it and when to draw it. But I don't think the court, the Fourth Amendment does still operate. The problem is technology tends to outpace the courts. I mean, these cases that are argued today, they all happened 3 and 4 and 5 years ago.
We go to some emails here and web comments and tweets just to get really, I think, salient questions being raised by listeners. Adam, for example, says, if I had a diary on me at a time of arrest, would they be able to search that? And what if it's not a cell phone, just a PDA of sorts?
These are great questions. And the analogies just go on and on and on. What if you were carrying actually your file cabinet with you with all your files in it? This idea of searching incident to arrest has never really been thoroughly analyzed when it comes to carrying very private documents. There was a diary case in the 1880s called Boyd where the court said you can't search a diary. Well, that case over the last 100 years has pretty much been relegated to the dust heap. But the initial feeling of the 1880s court was that's a private document, and the police can seize it and make sure it's not dangerous, but they shouldn't be allowed to go through it. So I think these analogies are all very good ones, and you will bet that today's report on the arguments today are going to be full of questions. What about this analogy? What about that analogy?
Now here's another one, a tweet from Vic who says, how is looking through my phone any different than reading my mail?
That's a good question. They're not supposed to read your mail, but if you're carrying your mail, this is an interesting question. If you're carrying an envelope and you've been arrested for drug dealing, they can seize it to make sure it's not dangerous. The question is, can they open it and read what's in there? And you would think the rule would be only if they think there's evidence in there at most. But that hasn't been the rule. The Rehnquist Court in 1972 or 73 said it doesn't matter whether they think there's any evidence, the right to search incident to arrest is automatic. I think you're going to see that rule cut back on in today's cases.
We're talking to Rory Little, professor of law at UC Hastings College of the Law, about Supreme Court and cell phones. And Eartha asks, what about after traffic accidents, even minor ones? Can police check your phone for evidence of texting while driving to help determine fault?
Great question. If they arrest you, they can, at least, you know, at least until today's decision gets decided. And many people would say, well, maybe that's a good thing. Maybe we should be tough on people who tweet while they, you know, or text while they drive. This is going to be the battle, right? We have very conflicting views, we as a society.
Well,
we want enforcement, but we don't want privacy invaded.
Yeah, it's a constant locking of the horns. I'm going to go to a caller here, Mike, who is actually asking a question that a lot of listeners are raising. Mike, go ahead.
Well, the most new smartphones offer an option to lock your phone using a password or passcode, which would seem to make the whole point of these searches and seizures by law enforcement moot. Then the only question becomes whether they can compel you to reveal your password or if there's some way to bypass that mechanism.
Yeah, it's a good question.
Right. Well, the courts have dealt with this to some extent. They're not consistent. Some courts have said they can make you give up your password. Of course, that takes some time. The other thing is that most law enforcement agencies now have technology where they can take your cell phone back to their office, hook it up to a laptop or something, and create an entire duplicate of the contents, whether it's locked or not. And again, the technology here is going to advance. Someone's going to invent a passcode that can't be bypassed. We have this issue of kill switches. Well, the government says if the drug dealers have kill switches, they'll just kill their phone every time they're arrested. So you have this back and forth with technology. The if it's a locked briefcase and you're carrying it, courts are divided. Can you search a locked briefcase? Can you break open the lock? So the analogies still operate whether you have technology or not.
And you wonder how much the justices really can stay up with technology. In fact, I think Michael from Stanford may bring this into the light here. Michael, welcome. You're on.
Yeah. You know, the justices strike me as very intelligent people who know a lot about constitutional law, but I wouldn't necessarily assume that they're up on the latest IT development. And I wonder, you know, to what extent are they even familiar or have, you know, used the devices in question? I mean, given that it's a pretty fact-specific inquiry, do you have any sense for that, or how they address questions like this when they don't, they aren't really familiar with the actual factual issues?
Yeah, I think that's a really, really good question. First, you can bet they all have four law clerks, and all those law clerks are in their 20s or early 30s, and you can bet they've had their law clerks into their chambers saying, how does that iPhone you carry work anyway? So you can bet that's going on. Some of the justices are pretty tech-savvy. Justice Kagan, I think, is. You can also get a clue about this. Jeff Fisher, the Stanford professor arguing for Riley, actually attached pictures of the iPhone, sort of front page to show the justices how many buttons you have to push to get to, let's just say, a text log or a call log or videos. So it's an interesting question. You know, they don't allow cell phones in the Supreme Court. Of course, the Supreme Court is well behind on technology for access. But I was wondering whether one of the lawyers might not bring their cell phone in and hold it up and say to the justices, here we go, here's a cell phone. Let's press some buttons right now.
Let me thank Michael for the call. Question here from a listener named Tom, who is wondering if the arguments before the court consider differentiating between data that is resident in the phone versus in the cloud, where apps on the phone have a persistent connection to a data store that is remote.
Well, that's a very good question. The government actually, and you know, we do have a Democratic administration right now. The government actually says in their brief, we do not believe we can search into the cloud. We only believe we can search what's on the phone. Now, the problem with that is sometimes you can't tell the difference. That is, some of these apps just are downloading from the cloud all the time. Sometimes you access an app, you don't know you're accessing the cloud, it comes down. So, I mean, this is a nice distinction, but the technology keeps advancing, and it's unclear whether that line. And then, you know, the government says we can't ask cops to sit there and make that distinction when they're sort of in a hurry to investigate a case.
Well, this case will continue, and we will, as I said, keep you apprised as the arguments unfold. And Roy Little, when I asked you to make a prediction or read the tea leaves before, you said it's going to be a very nuanced decision, but how do you think it's going to go? I mean, in terms of privacy.
I think your privacy is going to be protected to some degree in the Riley case. And the other case, which is just a flip phone and two buttons, I think that defendant may lose.
Good to have you with us. Appreciate your being with us.
Thanks so much.
That's Roy Little, professor of law, UC Hastings College of Law. When we return, we're going to talk about the ongoing struggle to have peace talks between the Israelis and the Palestinians, particularly in light of the fact that there's a pact now that has been made between Palestinians in Gaza and the Palestinians in the West Bank, that is Hamas and the PLO. When we return on Forum, I'm Michael Krasny.